Okay. It's Miss Newton.
Good morning.
Good morning. I better call the case. 112880, Basden versus Professional Transportation.
Yes, and I just want to make clear, I'm doing 5 minutes because we have amicus. So I have 5 minutes. She'll be arguing 5 minutes, and then I have a three-minute rebuttal.
What we have here is 7 minutes for you.
7 minutes, that's right. Seven, three, five, three,
rebuttal.
Sorry.
And five for Ms. Gant.
I was cutting myself short.
Okay.
All right. This case involves a claim brought by Terry Basden, who's a resident of Evansville, Indiana, appealing a ruling of summary judgment against her on a claim that she brought under the Americans with Discrimination Act and also under the Family and Medical Leave Act. The two primary issues to discuss on appeal would be whether the district court erred by holding that Ms. Basden was not a qualified individual with a disability and therefore entitled to ADA protection, and also whether the district court erred by dismissing the FMLA claim because she was not eligible for leave at the time that she was terminated.
Is there any evidence in the record that tells us how long that medication takes to work, or whether medication would allow her to return to work with more predictable attendance?
No, that evidence is not in the record. What is in the record is that Ms. Basden did start taking the medication not as soon as she would have liked. What's also in the evidence is that she, once she lost her job, she lost her insurance and also lost her income. So she wasn't able to start her medication as quickly as she wanted to. And that is in the evidence. And what is also in the evidence is that she did have her appointment with her specialist, and she did start taking the medication about a month later, which was effective and did allow her to return to part-time work, which is what she was doing at Professional Transportation.
And throughout this whole process, is it not correct that the evidence was that she would tell her employer that they knew that there was an issue of MS trying to be resolved here?
That is her position, yes, and that would be the evidence that would be most favorable to her case, was that she provided that information. The difficulty in diagnosing MS kind of lends itself complicates this case, because she initially started having falls about 6 months into her employment. When she went to the emergency room, she was referred to a neurologist, and that neurologist did some testing, did some MRIs, did a lumbar puncture, and said, I'm pretty sure you have MS, but let's get you to a specialist, because that needs to be the person who gets you your medication and decides how we're going to treat this. So the evidence that's most favorable to the plaintiff is that, yes, she brought in notes. There's at least one note that said that she was undergoing testing with regards to an MS diagnosis. And then also, when she did make her final request for accommodation, which was a request for a 30-day personal leave, on that, she asked for that leave for complications due to illness, in parentheses, MS. So that information was shared.
The question I have is that when she made that last request for 30 days.
Yes.
I presumed, looking at what was available, that she made that 30-day request because her specialist appointment wasn't until a certain date. Is
yes.
that right?
She made that request at the end of May when she had to miss work because of the symptoms that she was having. She knew she had an appointment at the end of June, which would have been within that 30 days. Now, it was at the very tail end of that 30 days, but that appointment was set within 30 days, and she did make that appointment.
Wouldn't it have been better for her to put in a request that her 30 days start around the time with a specialist and stay and keep trying to come? She was already on part-time, and then she would have gotten past that probationary period.
And that's what she would have preferred to do, because that's the only way she would have had any income. However, she wasn't able to work because of the disease, and she needed to get started on medication which would allow her to be able to work.
Did she ever give a doctor's excuse saying that she was not able to work until while this was pending?
No, she did not. But part of our argument here is that the burden is not entirely on Ms. Basden. I mean, she's an unsophisticated individual who's in the workplace, who is working for a company that has a human resources department that should be trained and understand the Americans with Disabilities Act. And part of her being qualified under the ADA is that she has to be a qualified individual with accommodation. And our claim is that had she been accommodated, she would have been qualified. And that needs to be taken into account in determining whether or not she's entitled to protection at all. And even had she had to be off work in excess of 30 days, the jury is the person, is the entity who's entitled to decide whether or not short-term leave, even in excess of 30 days, would have been a reasonable accommodation or not. And we're just asking to get this question to the jury and to let them decide, based on the facts that are in evidence, whether or not her request was reasonable and whether or not it would have made her qualified to keep her position.
What should we make of the evidence in the record that the plaintiff has been approved for Social Security disability? I realize that we know that only, of course, in hindsight, and that the employer didn't know it when it terminated her. But what are her damages if she subsequently could not work or could work only in very limited ways? And I know she has a job now, but it doesn't sound like a job with requirements that are similar to those that were imposed by PTI.
She has a part-time job now, continues to work as much as Social Security will allow her to work. And her measure of damages, I don't believe, and this is not in the record, that she was awarded damages retroactively to the time that she was terminated. So we're not looking at a huge amount of lost income, potentially, but we're looking at lost income for the period of time where she had no income, whether Social Security or not, and also for continuing part-time work. Again, there isn't evidence about what skills she has to use, but she has testified she is able to do her work, what she did at PTI. I mean, it was a clerical sit-down type job. I mean, there's phone calls and computer work and things like that, but we're not talking about physical labor. I'd like to address the FMLA claim because that is something that's
I'm wondering if there's any case law supporting the idea that persons who have not yet worked long enough to be eligible for coverage under FMLA can nonetheless sue when an employer engages.
Right. And
conduct that prevents them from reaching 1 year. I mean, is there any evidence in the record that the employer here was motivated by a desire to get rid of her before she became eligible for FMLA?
The evidence is that she was right at 11 months of employment at the time that she asked for leave. Had she had that 30-day leave, she would have had, I think, like 3 days back at work and then would have been eligible for 12 weeks of unpaid leave under FMLA. We're right on the verge of her being eligible. She asked for a different form of leave, and she's precluded from having that. So she's
terminated. That's the point. She went into the human resources director, and she asked for a leave, but she didn't ask, listen, I've only got a short time left. This is my situation. Can I do FMLA leave? She didn't ask that, right?
No, she did not ask for FMLA leave.
Personal leave.
But an employee isn't required to go in to human resources and say, I want FMLA leave. They're required to go in and say that they need leave because of a medical condition. They don't have to use the terminology or the name of the statute to do that. And there is case law. In fact, I updated my brief with a case out of the 11th Circuit and Parada versus Brookdale Senior Living Community that was just decided in January of this year, which was with a woman who was pregnant, found out she was pregnant before her 1 year of service had been put in, and indicated to her employer that she was going to need to take leave after her 1 year, and was harassed and then later terminated, and she was allowed to bring that claim. And there also is a Northern District decision, Northern Illinois District decision, that in Reynolds versus ICAR, that talks about an employee having a claim for discrimination that under the FMLA for an event that happens before they actually become eligible. Because our position here is that PTI was concerned that she would be taking leave under the FMLA and didn't want that to have happen and terminated her so that she couldn't take it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Gantz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Just to follow up on one of your questions about the evidence about whether she actually said she had MS, there's tons and tons of evidence in the record, not only through the doctor's note she submitted, but she also testified that everyone she knew and worked with knew of her condition. She also testified that she told the HR manager that she was having attendance problems because of MS. She didn't want to lose her job. Was there anything that she could do? Now, that was enough to trigger the interactive process right there. Instead, the company said, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do. If you quit on good terms, we might be able to rehire you. But that is not what the ADA requires. Because the definition of a qualified individual is with or without reasonable accommodation, they were obligated to work together with her to find out what would enable her to return to work and be able to perform the job without missing work. Now, she was highly motivated to come back to work. She was having symptoms, was doing the best she could, and even testified that she said she would come back to work if she was denied leave. But instead, they fired her. And I wanted to make clear that the interactive process is all about communication between the two parties so that they can work things out and not be in court.
Excuse me, counsel, when you talk about the interactive process, but the court was struck by the fact that she is saying, yes, I'd be qualified if there was an accommodation, but she's not a doctor. Now, she was having the symptoms. Everyone was saying you may have MS. She hadn't been diagnosed.
Right.
And she's saying, once I get this medicine, I'll be all right. I mean, she's not a doctor. How does she even know what would be the result of the medication she would get? She could be allergic to it or anything.
That's true, Your Honor. That's a very good point. What I want to make clear, though, she was probably – she had a CAT scan. She had a almost definitive – a probable diagnosis of MS. She had much testing, and the only thing left to do was to have the definitive diagnosis by an MS specialist. And the court found that she was disabled because of the symptoms she was having because of MS. Now, had the employer said, well, why do you need 30 days? What's going on? She could and asked for further clarification or even a note from the doctor or had called the doctor. Then they could have maybe figured out, well, she might need more than 30 days, she might need 60 days. But because the company had a personal leave policy of 30 days, that's what made her think of that. But it was incumbent on the employer to raise the fact that she had this, that there was a possibility of ADA leave, because the statute puts that obligation on the employer to work with her to find something that will work to get her back to work. Now, it's possible that if it turned out that she didn't have MS at all, then she wouldn't have been a covered individual with a disability. Or, as you had mentioned, if she ends up not being able to work at all, that would have reduced her – she wouldn't have been eligible for back pay and would have reduced her damages. But the company still would have been liable for, at the time, not granting her reasonable accommodation if there was one.
Now, who bears the burden of demonstrating whether the requested accommodation places an undue burden on the employer?
Under the statute, it is the defendant's burden, Your Honor. It's a covered entity must show the undue hardship. And they're not allowed to just say it's an undue hardship. They actually have to provide evidence of that. And obviously, the longer the leave, the more likely it would be they could show undue hardship. But I also wanted to point out that you don't want to have a rule where to guarantee that they'll be fully cured or able to come back, that an employee asks for the longest possible leave to make sure they're okay. You don't want to have a rule where 6 months is reasonable, but not 6 weeks. It's better for them to ask for what they think they need, and then if for some reason it's not working, come back, communicate with the employer, figure out if more leave is needed. Because if a person has few people with a serious illness diagnosed for the first time will know how long the treatment's going to take. So you don't want to have a rule where they just have to think, well, I need a year off and then I'll be fine. Because she really did believe once she started taking this medicine and she knew what the medicine was, that her symptoms would start to be alleviated. And she was not fully unable to work at the time. They were worsening in May. But she certainly was at least trying to come in and work, and she was highly motivated to come back. And the statute is all about people like Ms. Basden who are highly motivated to keep their job. She didn't want to be off leave as long as possible. She wanted to come back in a month and get back to work. The other thing is the employer should not be rewarded for lack of a better word, blowing off its obligations under the ADA. This is there's a lot of case law in this circuit and all the circuits talking about how the statute only works if there is this open communication between the parties. So here, instead of the company being liable for not enacting it, for not engaging in the interactive process and finding a reasonable accommodation that would allow her to come back to work, the burden had been totally on her to prove that she's going to be able to come back to work within a month, and that's not the correct burden to place on her. I don't want to take up any more time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Morning, Mr. Rock.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Robert Rock, and I represent the Professional Transportation Incorporated. I'd like to address first the issues in the record as far as the facts. When did the employer start to know about Ms. Basden's condition? I think Ms. Basden did testify in her deposition that she had told people at work, I've got this problem, I've got this condition. When you look at the testimony from the supervisors, they didn't have such a clear picture of it. But I think what's important...
Counsel, I'm going to stop you right there. They didn't have such a clear picture, testimony that she had told people. Isn't that an issue of fact? And if you look at it in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, it shouldn't be a summary judgment, should it?
I think you're right. You have to take it most favorable to the plaintiff in the summary judgment context. But I think it's important also to know the context of the communication that was going on between the parties. And the first record in her personnel file that shows anything with regard to MS is an April 23rd note from her doctor, and it says work up for MS. That's the first written document that's in her file, and I think you take her memory and you take that note, and I think that gives you a pretty good indication that somewhere around April of 23rd, 2008, that's when the employer was definitely on notice that this lady had some issues with regard to MS and was being investigated whether or not she had this condition.
And the question the court has is, you have this clear policy, that blanket, you all said attendance was a big priority for this job, you know, absenteeism was a big issue, and you just counted up the absences for that. You call them incidents, I believe, is what the term
yes,
is used. And part of those incidents, one of them was, what if you were sick for more than a few days? It's an incident. Do you equate being sick, maybe with the flu or having a cold for several days, with getting a diagnosis, a devastating diagnosis like MS or cancer? Or what does your company do about that? It seems like they just were trying to turn a blind eye to any absences that we don't want to know.
Well, I think the question really kind of goes to the heart of this case, and I think why the district court got it right in this case was because the plaintiff, Ms. Basden, didn't come with evidence to the employer to put them on notice from a doctor saying, hey, I may have MS.
Counsel, you just said they did in April.
Well, they said she was being worked up, is what it says in the note. It says work up for MS is all the note said.
But if the company required a doctor's note, wouldn't it be part of the interactive process to request it?
Well, I guess if I could, Your Honor, back up. I think we're getting the cart before the horse. I think what the district court did was they found that Ms. Basden was not a qualified individual with a disability. And on a failure to accommodate theory, which she has in this case, there's three elements, and that's the first one. The second was that the employer was aware of it, and I think the employer was aware of it by April 23rd for sure. She came in with a note on May 1st saying, I need to go to part-time, I can no longer work full-time, and she supported that with a note from her physician, and that was accommodated. The problem with the next event, and I think the government puts the cart before the horse, and then the government totally ignores that before you have to engage in the interactive process, the person has to be a qualified individual with a disability and they can perform the essential functions of the job. That was the problem in this case. She could not perform the essential functions of the job, which is attendance, and it was critical for this employer to have them there. They have to have those dispatchers there to provide the service that they provide for their clients, and she could not show up regularly, and it was erratic. It was unknown when she may or may not show up from the record. It was all over the place. And by the time she got to May 23rd, she could not show up. In fact, she didn't show up for work the day before and on that day. And she characterized her request as a 30-day request, but it really wasn't. It was an open-ended request because if you take a look, she's got a theory under FMLA and also under ADA. If you take her out 30 days, she's still not in the window for eligibility under FMLA, so she's really asking for more time. Plus, she's not competent to say that I'm going to be ready to work in 30 days. A physician had to give an opinion saying, look, if I can get Ms. Basden treatment, give her the injections or the medication that she needs, she'll be able to return to work. In that case, it's a totally different case then. Then if she had submitted a note like that from a physician, then there would probably be a factual issue in this case. But because she did not do that, as a matter of law, she fails because she can't prove that she was a qualified individual with a disability. She didn't meet the burden under the summary judgment framework, and that's the problem with her case.
You know, PGI has a policy allowing employees with more than 1 year of service to take short leaves of absence. If it's able to allow these leaves for employees with a year of service, what I'm trying to figure out is how it can be unduly burdensome to grant a similar ADA accommodation to an employee with 11 months of service.
Well, that's a very good question, and it's one I've also thought of myself, Your Honor. But if you remember, PTI is one company under the umbrella of the United Companies. The personal leave policy is a United Company policy. PTI has its own separate attendance policy because it's so critical for those employees to show up to work. Now, that's not to say that they would not have granted a leave under the United Companies policy if the person had been there a year, but it was within the company's discretion whether or not to do that. And, for example, in this case...
But is the company actually claiming that by the time the next month arrived, it would not have been unduly burdensome? Because that's what it sounds like.
No, the company, I think, is claiming that it would be an undue burden in this case because she is a dispatch employee. She's not one of the members of the other United Companies.
What I'm saying is after 11 months it would be, but after 12 months she could get the leave that she requested?
Not necessarily. And it's discretionary for the company, and I think it would depend on if you're a dispatch employee, it probably would be a little bit more difficult for you to get that type of leave versus if you're one of the United Company types employees. That would be factored in under those circumstances. But I think in this case, again, the problem is that she didn't support her 30-day or this leave request with anything that would give any assurance to the employer that she would be able to come back and fulfill the critical issue of attendance after that leave request if it had been granted. And when you review the cases that both parties have submitted to the courts in their briefs, there's a pattern that comes forward from this court's holdings, and that is that when an employee submits a accommodation request, whether it be leave or some other type of request, and that's supported by an opinion from a physician in most cases, then in those cases, then it's normally found that the employee is a qualified individual, and the employer at that point needs to engage in the interactive process. But in the cases where there's not any type of evidence in the record to support that type of request, then the decisions have been that the person is not a qualified individual and not entitled to the protections of the Act. And that's what we have in this case. And I think that's the pattern from this court's decisions. And unfortunately for Ms. Basden, she just didn't come forward with that type of evidence at the time. And it's also a problem in the interactive process as well, because it's not fair to an employer to not know what's going on when an employee just shows up and says, hey, I want 30 days off. Well, okay, but
wait a minute, counsel.
What's your reason for that?
When you say she just came in and said she wants 30 days off, she went to the human resources person, the director, told them what was going on, didn't get much response. Then someone else comes to her and says, you know, why don't you put in for 30 days? How are you saying that she's just coming out of the blue just saying, I need 30 days without any support?
I think, Your Honor, that goes back to the communication that was going on between the parties. It wasn't that clear.
Again, and that goes back to the fact this is a summary judgment finding, and it sounds like there's an issue of fact, isn't it?
I think the employer knew that she was being investigated, where the doctors were trying to determine whether or not she had MS. There was not a diagnosis at that time, and the company didn't know that, and they knew that she was having problems at work and she was missing work. All that, I don't think there's an issue on any of that. But the problem is when you request the leave, though, there's more of a burden on her to come in and just say, I want 30 days off. She has to come in and say, I need 30 days off, and Dr. Smith has told me that if I get this 30 days off, I'll be able to come back to work because he's got these injections or this medication that will make me able to do my job and show up. And she didn't do that. And that's the problem with the case. And I think that's only fair to an employer, any employer, that they have that type of information, and she didn't provide that. And that's the problem with this case. I think it's important, too, to realize, even though she said 30 days, it was open-ended because she's also wanting to tack on FMLA on the end of that. And her FMLA claim and the cases that were cited by counsel don't support her claim. Those cases are factually different from this case. She admitted in her deposition, I was not asking for FMLA leave. I was asking for PTI leave. There's no evidence in the record that anybody at PTI discussed or even thought of it as FMLA leave. And the employees in the cases cited by counsel on the FMLA were employees that were doing fine at work and just up front asked their employer before their eligibility time, hey, I'm going to need to take leave after I get to this year point for whatever the issue is. That didn't happen in this case. She didn't come to them and say, I need FMLA leave because of X, Y, or Z. She just said, I want to leave under PTI's policy. No, I'm not eligible for that. There's no evidence in the record to even support that, and she wasn't eligible at the time for it, and there was no indication to the employer at all that she was requesting that. And again, I think the problem with the government's position is if she had come in and supported her request with documentation from a physician, then yes, there would be the interactive process would be at that point would have to begin between the employer and the employee. But there was nothing provided to them to put them on notice that, hey, this person's got a problem and she's got a doctor who's saying there's a way to remedy it. We need to engage in this. They might not have said we can give you 30 days. They might have said something else. But at least the process would have been started. But until there's a note from the physician and her being able to show that she can actually do the job, which she couldn't anymore. She could not show up even for part-time. And she had from the beginning of that year, it just got worse. And then she went to part-time. She couldn't do that. And she just was not able to fulfill the essential functions of showing up for the job. And her request, also, the timing of it, came after she had already left work. So she really never engaged it. And her supervisor got the request in his inbox. He didn't even get to discuss it with her. So the communication was not there. And I think the government also said that they had shared test results and those sorts of things with the only thing that's in the file that said anything in her personnel file that said anything about EMS was that April 23rd note and then the May 23rd leave request. All the rest are just medical testing, or that unless you're a physician or you're somebody who knows what MS and what kind of tests they do for you, you're not going to know what that is. And that's unfair to place that type of burden on the employer. She also had a disparate treatment theory, and again it fails, I think, because she can't prove that she was a qualified individual and she wasn't meeting the legitimate expectations of attendance for the employer, and they've been consistent all the way through. In fact, when she called early on, that's why she was told that she was being terminated, because you can't show up for work. And so it's not a pretext by any stretch of the imagination. And for those reasons, we think the district court got it right. I think it's consistent. The district court's decision is consistent with this court's decisions. And it would be a departure to go in another direction at this point in time. So we respectfully request that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Ms. Newton, how much time does Ms. Newton have?
All right, I'll talk really fast. There is a factual dispute about whether or not the employer knew that Ms. Basden had a substantially limiting condition that would qualify her as a person with a disability. And there's no argument that's being made that MS or symptoms were not disabling in and of themselves. But the question here is whether or not she could perform the essential functions of her job with accommodation. Ms. Basden came to her employer and called Human Resources initially and said, "What can I do? I'm having an attendance problem because I'm sick. What can I do?" And she was told, "Well, you don't qualify for FMLA. You don't qualify for leave. You're going to be, you can quit and leave on good terms, and then maybe we'll rehire you." Well, that wasn't good enough for her. So she was assertive, and she did go to a Human Resources department in her own office area and talk to somebody there who gave her a form for this personal leave. And she thought, "Well, I'm going to try to get this personal leave then if I haven't been here for my year of FMLA. Let me try for this." So she says on there in the little area that she has to write, "I want 30 days leave because I have these complications due to MS." At that point, it was the employer's duty to just ask, why do you think you need 30 days? Does your doctor think you need 30 days? Could have called the doctor. Could have even asked Ms. Basden to submit to an IME. But what the appellee is asking you to do is to require that there be some kind of medical documentation requirement when someone submits a request for any kind of accommodation under the ADA. And that's simply not what the ADA requires, and that's not something that should be imposed upon plaintiffs who are making claims under it.
Thank you. All three of you, thank you so very, very much. The case, of course, will be taken under advisement. I hope you all don't mind, but